Chapter 10 Breakfast with a Foot Wizard. Bannermore appeared at breakfast the next morning looking like, well, like an itinerant foot wizard. That meant a threadbare cloak, plain but serviceable travel boots, leather breeches, and a thick woolen tunic. A large pack accompanied him to complete the look. Bannermore's story was pretty typical. I listened to it with great interest, because apart from a little luck in my case, I could have been him and he could have been me. The son of a peasant in the Western Riverlands, he had displayed flashes of talent at puberty. He started being able to direct chickens with his mind. He was tested by a spellmonger in Dorset, but was found too weak in his talent to warrant official training. Not enough for the man to invest in him, apparently. The spellmonger liked him, and did have an opening for a drudge, so Bannermore served an unofficial apprenticeship. During his drudgery, he picked up the rudiments of imperial magical theory, a few well-practiced skills, a couple of enchantments, some basic spellwork, and scores of minor cantrips well within his abilities. He was forced to flee his position in Dorset 10 years before, when the censorate came through town on an inspection tour. He had been wandering ever since, using his meagre skills in trade with peasantry across the Bontal Riverlands as best he could to make a living. And it actually wasn't that bad a living, he admitted over muffins that morning. "Mostly I work for peasants and artisans, the poor," he said, as he ate hungrily. "Summertime is best, of course. That's when everyone needs charms on their ploughs, finding lost llamas, pigs and goats, protection runes against vermin, my bread and butter." "There are many foot wizards who claim to be able to do all sorts of things," I said idly. I wasn't accusing the man, but I did want to know the kind of man I was dealing with. The point did not escape Bannermore's notice.
"I promise you, Mage Lord, I am not a charlatan. I never promise more than my spells can deliver," he said, as if it were a professional point of pride. "Hells, I could make thrice as much if I did, and I didn't mind a flagging reputation, but I'm an honest man. It's during the winters things get rough. I usually find some hamlet to hole up in, casting runes and sigils in exchange for room and board until they get tired of me, or the censorate gets close." He sort of looked like a mage, without violating any of the rules regarding our proper regalia. He wore a pointed hat, for instance, but it did not have the three smaller points sewn to the sides, the way an official mage's hat looks. Instead, he had a broad brim, suitable for keeping the sun out of his eyes and the rain off of his head. His cloak was embroidered with stars, but not with 7 points and not in the traditional pattern. Quite. Yet it was still suggestive. He wore a short woolen tunic and leather pants underneath, and a pair of good stout boots. He wasn't destitute. He apparently made or stole enough at his trade to afford decent clothes and the occasional trip to the barber, or took his fees in common trade, as so many of his profession were forced to do when coin was scarce. "Is that why you chose Sevendor to hole up in this winter?" I asked, surprised. "With the short rations and the chaos, I'd think you'd have better prospects elsewhere."
"This isn't so bad," he shrugged. "The food is decent, the people are friendly to Magi, even me, and for the first winter in memory I don't feel like I have to look over my shoulder every time I bed down."
"Because if the Royal Censorate shows up, they'll be focused on me," I said uncomfortably.
"Well, yes," he admitted. "And of course there is the allure of acquiring a witch stone," he added hungrily. "I know you don't think I have the talent for it, but, well, I'm hoping I can change your mind." He sounded very confident about it.
"That's a bold position to take," I observed, as I finished off the last of the baked apples. I was getting them for breakfast more and more, and they were getting smaller and smaller. "You know, I could have you thrown out. Or worse."
"I know that. But I did my research, spellmonger. You're a decent man," he said, as if it was common knowledge. "In fact, you're a hero. And your people love you. The whole village was abuzz last night about how fair and just you were in court, and I haven't heard that about a lord very often at all."
"I just haven't gotten jaded and cynical yet," I dismissed. "I'm still new at this."
"Fair enough. You've made a good case, and assuming you are as honest a man as you are ambitious,
I'll also assume that you're willing to curry my favour if given the opportunity. This is your opportunity. I'm a stranger to this region, and there are things I would like to know. You seem like you might know things I'd like to. I am at your disposal, Mage Lord, he said, nodding gravely. What do you wish to know? I need to know who among the local lords, saving the West Flareans, have need of a powerful mage in their realms. Contract work, not a permanent position at court, of course. I just need a few lords with ready cash and a need for magical assistance.
An interesting question, Mage Lord, he nodded. I know of three such, at first thought, though only one will be at all simple, I think, and only one will be richly remunerated.
And it would be unlike the gods to situate both of them in the same job.
The gods are capricious that way, I've noticed,
he agreed.
The easiest work would be for Sire Sigilan of Trestendor,
the fief on the other side of West Flareia, I nodded. I've heard of him. He has lost half of his domains to West Flareia and Sashtalia, and deprived of those revenues, he has little means of seeking redress.
I'm not of a mind to get involved in my neighbour's real estate disputes, I warned. That's bad precedent, at least until I can secure my own lands.
I understand, Mage Lord, Bannermore agreed. That's not why I mentioned him, however. The small fief Sire Sigilan has left is high in the hills, a lone castle and a few scattered hamlets. But there is wealth there, if he had means to secure it, or wit to recognize it.
What kind of wealth?
Actually, I had an idea about that. I just wanted to hear what he knew. The mountain range Sevendor lies at the northern skirt of is part of the Yawari range, and compared to the majestic Mindans or the stately Kulins, they weren't much to look at. But that didn't mean they lacked in mineral riches. I read up on them when I was doing research on my choice of domains in Wilderhall, thanks to a dusty old folio I found in the palace library that likely had only been read 3 or 4 times since it was written. It was by one Gadaran, the sage, a natural historian of some repute in his own time, but whose legacy, as far as I could tell, extended to a discourse on the Yawari Hills with an examination of the land, its history, and its people. The archaic style of High Permanese of a century ago made it quaint, but nothing could make it any more entertaining. That book was better at inducing sleep than a well-cast Aeon's dream charm, but it was filled with facts about the hills in meticulous imperial style, which made it terribly useful. The tallest peak of the range was Mount Anvril, 300 miles southeast of Sevendor in Cararosa, and it rose a barely respectable 4,200 feet above the rivers below. The range was mostly grey basalt, with outcroppings of granite and deposits of sedimentary rock. There was no iron, tin, silver, or lead, but there were veins of copper and occasional deposits of gold, pockets of coal, and in several places you could find emeralds, sapphires, rubies, and other semi-precious stones. There were also rarer minerals, useful in alchemy and exotic enchantments, but otherwise useless. There were plenty of natural caverns throughout the range, and that's what attracted the original inhabitants to the region. Once, long before humans ever settled the rich riverlands of Castol, the Yawari Hills were part of the domain of a species of non-humans called the Stone Folk, known to the learned as the Karshak Elon. They are apparently distantly related to, or derived from, things get pretty murky when you speak of such histories, the Alka Alon, and were seen in import just behind the tree folk. Like most non-humans, they are shorter than we, the tallest a mere 5 feet. They usually have a long, shaggy mane of hair, light brown to dark brown, very different from the furry black pelts of the Gavani or the soft brown fur of the river folk. It encircles their heads and covers their faces, unlike the Alka Alon or the Talalon, who grow no thick facial hair. They are reputed to be very strong, able to endure great hardship, and are legendary for great feats of endurance. Though they are fierce and doughty warriors, according to legend, they were not themselves warlike, and usually only fought in defense of their mines and grottos. They were closely related to the Kizarai, known as the Alon Dradrian, the Iron Folk. Indeed, the two species were often indistinguishable to humans unless they knew the subtle differences. The main one was their hair. The Alon Dradrian had black, grey, or golden blonde hair, typically,
while the Alon Karshak ran to red or brown hair, or a kind of mottled mixture of the two. According to scholars, the Alon Dradrian often ruled colonies of the more numerous Alon Karshak, acting almost as a ruling class, and while the two races could and did sometimes breed, the crossbreeds were almost always sterile mules. The Karshak Alon weren't always happy with the rule of the minority iron folk. Occasionally they rebelled, founding their own colonies or kingdoms deep underground, or in very remote mountain cities. I knew one more important thing about them. There weren't very many, if any, left around Kalador, or at least around the Five Duchies. There were rumours of secret colonies in the central Kulines and the southern Mindans, and perhaps they were more numerous elsewhere. But their subterranean lairs were as elusive and difficult to find as the tree cities of the Alka Alon. But they had lived here once. A largish mining colony had been delved into the Living Rock, somewhere in the mountains south of Sevendor. I can't really explain how I came by the information, for other reasons that I can't explain, but I knew that colony had the potential to be a valuable resource to me someday. Somewhere behind my castle, behind the cliff, was a long-forgotten city of the Karshak Alon. I even had a name, Askirast. For over a century, a clan of Karshak Alon had ruled there during the early days of the Majocracy. By the time my ancestors invaded and conquered the Empire, Askirast was long abandoned for reasons unknown, and it was out there, close to my fief, somewhere. The Karshak Alon practiced some very sophisticated magics, some as complex and elegant as the Alka Alon. As the technicians of the great Alon Empire of ages past, they had developed immense technical knowledge and thaumaturgic skill. They were enchanters of surpassing excellence. They were adept at metallurgy, though not as much as the Iron Folk, mineralogy and stonemasonry, in which they far surpassed the Iron Folk. Being a reclusive and cautious species, as well as slow to reproduce, they naturally sought out remote, geologically rich areas that were easily defendable, like the Uwaris. They came for the bauxite deposits and the load of gold that once ran through the range, as well as a few modest deposits of precious stones. They stayed because the place was far away from the other Alon kingdoms, who frequently warred with each other. After the violent rebellions of the Gavani and a wave of wars between Alka Alon kingdoms, the Karshak Alon had hidden themselves. They had had enough. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to keep them out of the brutal class war of the Gavani. The Alon servile class was poorly disposed to the Karshak Alon. They viewed them as part of the ruling class. Though they had allied with some rebel clans of the Alon Dradrian, they usually slew the Karshak Alon wherever they found them. The Gavani workers fought for their freedom, destroying the Alon kingdoms one by one, until the two races were forever sundered. The other non-human races simply fought for their lives, but the Karshak clans were forced by circumstance to choose sides based on their own interests, and they didn't always choose wisely. Legend says that a seventh of the Stone Folk were wiped out in a 7-year campaign. The Stone Folk like a lot of sevens, and that blow was too grievous to bear. They regrouped deep within the larger mountain ranges in heavily fortified underground cities, abandoning their lesser works. The Uwari tribe, who had built and lived in Askirast, was absorbed by one of the larger tribes, and the Stone Folk faded from local memory and into legend when humans came here. I had met two Stone Folk in my life, both odd little fellows in the employ of the Duke. They were difficult to talk to because their attention always seems to be elsewhere, and they can be obsessive perfectionists to the point that is maddening to a human. But the things they did, I had wondered if Bannermore had any hint of where I might find their ruins. It turns out he had more than I expected. It is said that once the Uwaris were a kingdom of the Stone Folk, before the invasion, and they tarried here in part because of the minerals in these hills. Among the more exotic are veins of a red chalky mineral known as Lordin. Do you know of it? No, I admitted, chagrined. I had always hated alchemy. Lordin is highly prized by the weavers of Merwin, as it makes a deep, rich red dye when fixed with lye, and the colour is much in demand along the coasts. Indeed, from what I understand, most of Merwin's Lordin comes from Faerys, one reason why the Merwini did not object to the invasion.
A brick of well-refined lording can fetch a handsome price at market.
How handsome? And how well-refined?
Mage Lord, I do not pretend to be a merchant, but I am given to understand that it runs to 50 ounces of silver and up, per 1 pound brick.
That is impressive, I agreed.
Considering the distance it had to be shipped, and assuming a brick of the stuff was more or less the same size and weight as a brick of clay, then even after transport costs, that would be a tidy profit.
And Sire Sigalan has no idea of his riches.
He knows he has red clay,
Bannermore shrugged.
He knows it is called Lordin in the East, but his knowledge ends there. It seems to me, however, that a high mage, well practiced in earth magics, could assist in extracting the valuable commodity from the lands, splitting the profits with Sire Sigalan.
An intriguing idea, I agreed, without much enthusiasm. I was busy trying to fix my own domain after all.
But there is more, sire, he continued insistently. What is not generally known is that within the chalk can be found occasionally these, he said, placing a small stone on the table. I believe they're called Falahaudi in High Perwanese.
Yes, yes they are, I said excitedly, instantly enchanted with the uninteresting-looking rock.
Falahaudi are magically sensitive stones. They don't provide power, like Irionite, and they aren't heavily regulated by the censorant, but they do have some impressive uses. They're one of a few dozen substances that are absolutely required for some kinds of enchantments, and not the kind that keeps your wagon axle from breaking.
Falahaudi, or sympathy stones, are curious mineral formations that look like a kaffir bean or a walnut.
There's a very clearly discernible equator between the two hemispheres, and if you know what you are doing, and use the right spells, and are good enough, you can split the stones just right. After that, whatever happens to one stone happens to the other. Drop one in water, the other gets wet. Put it in flame, and the other gets hot. But they can do so much more. Properly enchanted, you can do all sorts of impressive spells that require an agent or trigger from a distance without having to go through the other world or find another means of acting. The stones maintained a magical connection upon separation as a natural property, and without any additional enchantment or expenditure of energy for the mage. The two stones were forever tied, and the places in the universe where each half lie were also tied, according to the experiments in the early magocracy.
Remarkable,
I nodded, picking up the uncut stone and turning it over in my hand.
And it's authentic.
Oh, yes, he assured me. He pulled another stone, slightly larger, maybe 3 inches across, from his pouch. Half a stone, actually. He pressed it into my palm, and it felt hot to the touch.
Its mate is lodged in the bottom of the fireplace of a busy inn in Sendaria Port, he explained.
For 2 years, it's kept my hands from freezing in the wintertime. About all I could manage with it myself, but...
Those things are worth a fortune, I nodded.
How many do you have?
4, counting this one, he said, pocketing his hand warmer again.
The other 3 are intact. I traded for 2 and found 2, all discovered around Trastendor in pockets of raw lording.
Mine the lording, find the Falahaudi, and then sell or use the sympathy stones.
That's a brilliant idea, I agreed. Let me look into it. But Sire Sigalan's pockets are empty and I need cash.
Who else?
He sighed. There is a knight, Sire Remius, a lord of a prosperous estate in southwest Sendaria called Birchroot. It lies on the banks of the River Sendra, 20 miles south of the fork with the Bontol. Sire Remius' estate grows a number of quality smoking weeds, and while he sells a large part of them to a broker downriver, he could make a lot more if he could sell them in the town of Jeroen, just across the river. The problem is that the bridge that once made that an easy journey has failed. It's an old Wenshari bridge, pre-conquest, and the spells failed. Restoring that bridge would shorten Remius' journey to Jeroen by 2 days and many tolls, and that would be worth a lot to him.
Interesting, I said, thinking about Rondal's talent with stone magic.
And the last? I assume it's the most remunerative.
In my estimation, Mage Lord,
the Foot Wizard agreed, it concerns the Baron of Sendaria, Erathaniel.
He is one of the last scions of an old and distinguished House Lensley, still in possession of his ancestral lands. Baron Arathaniel's seat is at Chepstow Castle. Chepstow Castle, he explained, was built on an island in the middle of the river, an impressive fortress, nearly impregnable, one of the oldest in the land, dating from the very first decades of the conquest, it is said. From its strategic position, it controls both sides of the river, and it is ringed with smaller castles to support it. It has never been taken in battle. From its fastness, the barons of Sendaria have been able to hold all the riverlands below the cataracts to Sendaria on Bontal. The riverport was easily the most lucrative property in this region of the riverlands. Control of it meant thousands every week in revenue for the lord. I had paid a fortune in tolls to the baron myself, thanks to the number of refugees who came through his town. I didn't mind the idea of recovering some of that wealth. If he was a rich lord, I was interested in him as a client. The baron represents the last of the landed Lensleys in the region. House Lensley has mostly moved on to a greater position or their possessions in the south of Caston. Arathaniel's branch of the family mostly stayed out of the dueling last century, sticking to their estates like proper country gentlemen. When the dust settled on the inheritance disputes, his line was the last one left in power in the region, and their seat is at Chepstow Castle. I appreciate the history lesson, I said patiently. I'm still waiting for the job. A little background is required, Mage Lord, he assured me. The upshot is that Arathaniel is now caught between the ambitious barons to either side of him, with no clear allies in sight. He can hold his own thanks to the Sendaria port revenues, Chepstow Castle, and a strong band of loyal vassals behind him. But if any one of those three things fails, then his land will be doomed by the next generation. In fact, his line's motto is Coin, Castle, Comrades. His neighbours will begin warring with his descendants, and soon the barony of Sendaria will be but a memory, his line extinct. This is the question that lies mightily on the baron's head. And magic can fix that? I asked, confused. I don't see how simply, Mage Lord. Every spring equinox, His Excellency sponsors a great fair in Chepstow, a tournament in honour of his noble children, held since the birth of his eldest son, Arliston, 30 years ago. The Chepstow Spring Fair is famous in these parts, the first fair of the season. Over the years, it has grown to fill all the Chepstow Commons, attracting thousands. It's highly lucrative for all involved. It is where artisans show off their best work done in the darkness of winter, and folk are hungry for new crafts and often in need. There are bargains aplenty in Chepstow Spring Fair. It is how Arathaniel demonstrates the famed greatness of the Lensleys to his neighbours, and even the local barons sometimes attend, so entertaining is the fair. But it is also a target for his enemies. Last year there were brawls aplenty, seemingly mere drunks and rogues, the usual fare. That despite the coin brethren of Ifnia taking fair oaths of every participant. Last year the fights all seemed to do a lot more damage than usual. Merchant stalls, artisans' booths, many were affected, until the baron had to pay out significant coin in recompense. His men, investigating, discovered that some of the brawls were staged affairs by hired thugs. While the ringleader was never discovered, it is widely believed that it was the Baron of Bokeraton, Sindaria's greatest rival. He covets the port city, you see, and sees Arathaniel as the last relic of an earlier age. And Bokeraton plans a rival fair of his own for high summer, with a grand tournament of champions next year. If the Chepstow Spring Fair is disrupted and Sendaria falls into ill repute, then Bokeraton's fair will be packed, and next year Sendaria won't draw enough merchants to cover costs, and the Baron will lose much respect in Sendaria on Bontal. I think I see, I said reluctantly. So, essentially, you think that if I use magic to guarantee a peaceful and prosperous fair for the Baron, I summarized.
Exactly, Mage Lord.
Bannermore nodded. I think such a service would be worth considerable coin to His Excellency. Not to mention potentially adding a powerful military ally in the region, should all go well.
I hadn't considered that,
Bannermore admitted. I'm looking at it from a mercantile point of view.
Yes, being a lord complicates things.
I grumbled. I used to be a spellmonger. All I cared about was the mercantile point of view. I enjoyed it. Now I'm responsible for stuff, and I'm not enjoying it as much as I thought I would. If it makes you feel better, Bannermore said conspiratorially. You're a God's blessed hero to us on the road, he said, meaning his fellow foot wizards. Admittedly, half of us don't have half the talent we think we do, and are only good for a handful of reliable spells. But it's an honest trade, save for it being utterly illegal. The censorate is always after us. With that not being a problem suddenly, we don't have to look over our shoulders all the time. Mostly we just avoid them anyway. But now that His Grace has effectively ended their power in Castle, it's like we're real folk again, he said. And we all know who stood up for all Magi, high and low, at Wilderhall. And then he went and became a mage lord, Minolan the Spellmonger. I hadn't much thought about how that would help you folk, I said, although that wasn't entirely true. The censorate spent half its time running around terrifying such minor magi, the self-taught or folk-taught. I knew just how much my papers as a professional mage had protected me from bitter harassment. Well, it has, Bannermore said resolutely. I'm just surprised I'm the first one to come to your door, but I won't be the only one. And even though you haven't seen fit to gift me with a stone, and I understand, Mage Lord, I mean no disrespect, it's clear to me that being close to you is better for my health than not. Since I don't have the talent to warrant a stone, then I'll do the next best thing. With your permission, I'd like to go into business in the safety of Sevendor, brokering such items as the Sympathy Stones and other curiosities that appeal to our trade. Indeed, there will be several foot wizards doing just that at the Chepstone Spring Fair, should the Baron favour us with a merchant's permit. Without fear of the censorate, we might just make a decent living now. Let me consider it, I nodded. I can see the strength of your argument. Since I have to protect myself and my apprentices from the fury of the censors, you might as well be here too. Have you considered that being in Sevendor is the surest way to be in their path, should they go hunting? I have, he nodded, but you've got Irionite. They don't, or if they do, they aren't talking about it much. In any case, a mage lord and a couple of knights magi should be more than enough to contend with them. I wasn't as optimistic, I suppose, but it was nice being seen as strong. Besides, he continued, his voice even lower, no war mage in his right mind is going to go up against the first mage to conjure a fire elemental in the middle of a battle. At least, that's the rumour. Is it true? He asked earnestly. It was, I said, torn between not wanting to brag about it and wanting someone who understood what was involved to appreciate it from a technical standpoint. It was a very complicated spell and required hundreds, but yeah, I conjured one, a huge one. I kept it going for the better part of an hour. It slew thousands, I said, feeling a mixture of pride and shame in the admission. It was pretty impressive.
I can only imagine,
Bannermore said, his eyes wide. So, no. No war mage in his right mind is going to come knocking on your door lightly. I can see your point, I nodded. Now if only that idiot to the north would see it, I could sleep better at night. I'm afraid Sire Gimbal is not impressed by such tricks, Bannermore smiled. He only sees the value in acres, horses, lances, and swords. As to your earlier request, yes, you can set up shop here. You seem like a reasonable enough fellow, and you haven't caused any trouble. Rondal even said that you've been hanging around the lumberyard, trying to pick up a few tips, and you've helped out on the commons with small things. Yes, I listened to gossip. I'll do what I can, he shrugged. Like I said, I've wintered in worse places, with worse company. I like it here. The Bavali are a jolly lot, considering what they've been through, and the Sevendori. Well, they're not so bad, now that they have a decent lord. I was here 3 years back. It was a wasteland. A damn shame. I'm going to grant you a license to do business in my lands. As a merchant, I stressed. Any magic you do, that's between you and your clients. Call yourself whatever you like. Spellmonger, mage, wizard. I don't care. But I'm encouraging you to begin brokering soon. Because you're right. I am going to be attracting both friends and foes at Sevendor, and my friends and I are going to need components from time to time. I know I am. For the spell work I envision here, I'll need a lot of unusual merchandise, so there will definitely be a profit available. Once the housing shortage is addressed, I'll even loan you the funds to build a proper shop in the village. The first of several, I warned. I'm not granting you a monopoly here, but you'll be the first and probably the largest vendor of such wares, if you don't get on my nerves, I added. I'm a very easygoing sort, he assured me, and I appreciate the opportunity. You've been more than generous. There's something else I want, though, I said thoughtfully. If you're correct about your fellow foot wizards and they start drifting in, then I want you to be my unofficial liaison to them. If you've been on the road as long as you've said, you know which are legitimate and who the crooks are. Sort them out for me, will you? Send any confidence men on their way, but any real foot wizard can find sanctuary here as long as he obeys my rules. And anything they happen to overhear on their journeys, which might be of interest to a mage lord, would be well rewarded. With Eirir Knight? He asked anxiously. We'll see, I shrugged. But probably not. You have to understand, as much as I'd like to hand out witch stones at will, there is a very limited supply and there is a war on. My highest duty is to fight the dead god. So those with the greatest talent, the best training, and who can fight, get first priority. Anyone else I think will aid the war effort gets second. But I'm making this up as I go along, so you never know what circumstances the gods may bring. Isn't that always the case? Then I remain your servant, Mage Lord. Bannermore bowed from the waist. Usually some sort of fee is customary in such a case, yet my purse is embarrassingly anemic. However, he said, lifting another sympathy stone from his pocket, at current market rate, this should be more than enough to cover it, I think. He said it in such a way as to imply that any differing opinion would be widely out of reason. I liked the tactic and resolved to adopt it. And more than enough to cover the cost of construction for a shop, I agreed, and your taxes for the first 2 years. I wasn't exactly certain what an uncleft sympathy stone was worth, but I knew it was at least 20 ounces of gold. Of course, as a foot wizard, Bannermore wouldn't have been able to provide the proper documentation, so he wouldn't have been able to fetch that kind of price, so we were both coming out ahead in this bargain. The foot wizard took his leave after that, and a few days later, Sir Kay brought me a request for a lot on the part of the village high street. Well, I was hoping it would be a real high street one day. I signed it, and before a week had passed, the enterprising Bannermore had erected a ragged cloth pavilion on the site and started doing business as a hedge wizard. Sir Kay was naturally suspicious of the man, of all magi, actually, but accepted it as one of my lordly whims. He couldn't seem to get his head around the idea of another mage in competition with my apprentices and me. But the fact was that the three high magi had so much work to do with restoring, ordering, repairing, and preparing the fief that we didn't have time to do all those little things for which a village depends on a spellmonger or hedge wizard. If Bannermore could eke out a living filling that need, then gods love him. We just didn't have time. Sir Kay was a little more forgiving of Bannermore's shop as a paying tenant, and once I explained the value of the man's information and the sympathy stone, he had the wit to see why I was interested at once. Having been the castellan for Beauval Vale, he had handled the tax and fee accounts for all of the major villages and the town. He appreciated the role of merchants in terms of revenue better than most landed knights would have. They tend to see everything in terms of acreage and bushels of grain. One of the first jobs I'd had as a professional war mage involved the snit between a baron and his vassal over, I'm utterly serious, 6 acres of farmland. My fee alone would have purchased the parcel outright. But this noble idiot's honour wouldn't let him see that sacrificing a prosperous hamlet, an inn, and a busy mill, not to mention risking his life, the lives of his men, and my own potentially dying in battle, was a poor trade for a lonely, mediocre estate of 6 acres and 60 bushels of corn. At the time, I had scoffed that if I were a lord, I'd not make such stupid mistakes, never for a moment dreaming I'd ever have the opportunity. But here I was, looking at a rapidly declining treasury, a fief on the edge of hunger, unfriendly neighbours, uneasy peasants, inscrutable dukes and murdering duchesses to whom I'd pledged my fealty, and a pregnant lady who was due at any time. Suddenly dying in battle didn't seem like such an unreasonable prospect anymore.